It's 4:06. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Alzheimer's Association International Conference is going on this week in Copenhagen. We'll learn about some of the latest research on the disease and what we can do to maybe prevent memory loss in our own lives.
First, a new program undertaken by the Rock County Sheriff's Office and the Humane Society of Southern Wisconsin hopes to give both inmates and dogs a second chance.
The Canine Corrections Academy is reportedly the first of its kind in the state. It pairs dogs who have been deemed unadoptable with Rock County jail inmates who are given the opportunity to train and help rehabilitate them.
Sheriff Robert Spoden joins us. He's the Rock County Sheriff. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, give us an overview of the Canine Corrections Academy. How does it work?
Well, the Canine Corrections Academy basically is designed to meet the needs of the needs of animals and also the needs of inmates. And, you know, what we have seen far too often is that, inmates that have been part of our RECAP program basically have never really successfully completed anything. Far too often they've initiated different aspects in their life of programs or whatever they were involved in, but they've never followed through. And this gives them an opportunity to be responsible not only just for improving their behavior, but being responsible for improving the behavior of a dog that currently is not adoptable. And typically a lot of those dogs just have not had good human interaction. They've not had an opportunity to learn social skills that they can, you know, use to become a good household pet. And so what we do is the inmate is paired with the dog that the Humane Society has identified. We've identified the inmates are going to actually do this. They actually had to, sign up. They had to go through an interview process. Obviously, they were screened. We didn't allow anybody that had a violent history or anybody that had been abusive to either, people or humans, but people or animals. And so it has so far been very successful. And, you know, while it's in its early stages, we've been very pleased with not only the interaction of the inmate with the dog, but even the interaction of the dog with the other inmates that are housed up in the dormitory area where this dog actually stays.
Talk a little bit about who's training the inmates to train the dogs. How do they get the proper training to know how to teach the dogs basic skills?
Well, we're very fortunate. We actually have two retired deputy sheriffs, Matt Pine and Don Miller, and they're actually dog handlers. They actually do that on the side. And they volunteer to come here and work with the inmates and mentor them and give them the skills that they're going to need to train these dogs, as well as, you know, be involved themselves. So it's been a very win-win situation for everybody.
So what does it take to get a dog to become, quote, adoptable? What kinds of things are the inmates training them?
They're teaching them basic commands, the ability when you're on a leash that there's, you know, you can't just yank the person around. They're teaching them, even things, simple things as how to crate themselves, you know, how to, go and sit down, just very, what we take for granted, very basic skills for dogs. A lot of these animals have never been taught that. And so it gives them an opportunity to do that. And it also is teaching these inmates that, you know, you're going to have to be more responsible for, you know, not just yourself, but another living thing. And at the end of this training session, these dogs will be adoptable. And then we'll advertise. The families will get to come out to the sheriff's office. The inmate will be part of the interview process, as will be someone from the Humane Society and someone from the sheriff's office. And then we'll interview the family and make sure that it's a good fit. And then the dog will be turned over to the family and hopefully have a very happy life. And hopefully this will inspire the inmate to realize that, you know, I can be part of something beyond myself, that I can do something positive for my community, and that I can make a difference in a dog's life, and I can help prevent this dog from perhaps being put down. And that in itself, I think, is going to be a valuable life lesson for these inmates.
I imagine, too, that handing a dog over after you've spent so much time with them to a family, although it's a happy ending, it's also probably, quite an emotional loss for the prisoner, or for the inmate who's, become attached to it.
Yeah, you know, we anticipate that's going to happen, but at the same time, you know, we've been very upfront with them that, you know, this is a temporary, you know, situation that you're in. This is something that you're really just preparing this dog to actually go and have a permanent home. And so while it's important for you to develop a relationship with the dog, you need to always keep in mind that, you know, this is going to come to a close, and this dog is going to go to a home, and hopefully you prepared it, and that's really your responsibility, preparing it to be a good pet.
Did you say that they're living with the dog as well?
Yes, the animal, and his name is Duke. Duke is actually up in the living area of the dormitory-style housing area that we have. It's actually called E-Unit. And he's in there, and he's able to interact with other inmates. And we had a very positive response from the inmates about Duke. And, you know, as everyone knows, you know, having a dog in a prison or a jail situation reduces tension. It reduces, you know, hostility, and just adds to a better all environment for not only the animal, but for, you know, the inmates.
How many inmates are working with Duke?
We have one that is the primary handler, and his name's Ryan Lambert, and then we have a secondary handler, Tobias Turvey, he backs up Ryan. So that part of our program where these inmates are at is that they have to go through educational processes, they have to learn job skills, they have to do community service work. If they have alcohol or drug addictions, they have to go through counseling for that. So they have a schedule of events. So if Ryan is going to have to be gone, or Ryan is going to be tied up in a class, then Tobias can help out as far as, you know, working with the dog. So they both have been selected. However, Ryan is the primary caregiver.
And I don't know the criminal histories of these two particular inmates, but I'm curious what the future might hold for them, and whether the skills obtained through this program is something that they will someday possibly get to carry on, you know, back in normal civilian life outside of jail.
And that's what our hope is. And, you know, with the RECAP program, you know, we try to take a wide approach to what led these people to get into jail. I've always said and been very adamant that I don't think that when you're an 8-year-old little boy or an 8-year-old little girl that, you know, you say, you know, when I grow up, I want to be in jail or I want to go to prison. But somewhere down the line, these inmates have not developed in a really more appropriate manner. They don't have the necessary skills to be productive in our community. So this gives them an opportunity to be responsible, to develop some type of a relationship, and to complete something. Again, you know, being able to say, I actually took this dog that was not adoptable, I worked with him, I trained him, and now he's adoptable and he's going to a good home. I think that just that, as far as their confidence and self-esteem, is really going to pay some very big dividends.
Do you have plans to possibly expand the program in the future?
Yes, we actually already have a 18-month-old puppy that does not play well with other puppies, and so he's going to be coming out in about a week. And then we're looking at hopefully by August or September to have 4 dogs in here at the same time and working with them. One of the funny side things that has been happening is we've been getting phone calls from people in the community that say that actually say, well, you know, my dog is kind of being naughty and doesn't really listen to me. Would you guys be willing to take my dog and just work with him for 2 weeks and see if you can train him? which obviously we can't, but, you know, it's been, thus far, the community has been very receptive to it, and I think that they see that it's a good program, and we've had great buy-in.
Great. Well, thank you, Sheriff Spoden, for being with us today.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. That was Rock County Sheriff Robert Spoden telling us about a new Canine Corrections Academy, which pairs unadoptable dogs with prison inmates in hopes of rehabilitating them. The Alzheimer's Association International Conference is going on next week in Copenhagen. Researchers are presenting lots of new studies on how preventative treatments and lifestyle changes could affect rates of Alzheimer's disease in the United States.
Here to discuss some of the studies coming out this week is Carrie Patterson. She's the executive director of the South Central Wisconsin chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Carrie, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much. I wish I was in Copenhagen, but I'm happy to represent what we're doing there.
Great. Well, a lot of the research over there seems to be focused on prevention, studies showing the kinds of things that might help prevent Alzheimer's. Is this growing as a promising path for research?
Yes, absolutely. I think each year we're gaining insights through the Alzheimer's Association International Conference. This year it's going on through this Thursday in Copenhagen. And really what we're finding is when we combine all of these wonderful talents throughout the globe is the discussion is moving to earliest detection of signs and stages of this disease. A lot of that is coming through the formats of clinical biomarkers, imaging, types of imaging that we can see different markers with amyloid or different plaques and tangles in the brain and structure changes. And so we're hoping that since cognitive side effects are really kind of the last side effects that families notice, if we can start to see some of those biomarkers, we might be able to intervene sooner. So it's actually a pretty fascinating and exciting time for a disease that really has no cure or prevention at this point.
So that would be early detection part of it, finding those biomarkers.
Exactly. So far, we've had mostly very invasive types of biomarkers to detect Alzheimer's disease in its earliest stages. Those have relied on spinal fluid or advanced types of brain imaging. And now we're seeing highlights in the news of smell tests, eye tests, just these really simple things that could be a noticeable stage of risk assessment, which is a new topic for the field.
And it seems like some of the prevention is focusing on lifestyle changes. Headlines out saying, up to a third maybe of Alzheimer's cases might be preventable with things that we usually associate with heart health, exercise, better diet, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, all those things that your doctor was telling you to do to get out and get active and eat colorful fruits and vegetables, that's really been a huge interest in the field of Alzheimer's. So we've seen, how our whole systems really work together to help support us as we age in general. And we're seeing a lot of benefits from people who not only change their lifestyle and eating habits, but also incorporate some cognitive challenges as well. Learn a new language, play a puzzle or a game, and get social with our friends. Those are really some of the best learnings that we're finding in these new and exciting studies that have shown delaying onset of Alzheimer's disease. And maybe it could be a type of prevention.
So with a lot of research focused on prevention and early detection, it seems like there's good news along those lines. Is there a bad news side of this on continued difficulty finding treatments once we know someone has Alzheimer's?
Well, I don't think the field has really lost sight of trying to find new interventions. All of these studies are going to give us insights into the actual pathology and development of Alzheimer's disease. But I think what's really going to be exciting is that we might be able to try some of those new medications much sooner while the brain has more function and different kind of synapses still healthy and alive, where if we can identify some potential risks or triggers to the disease, there is a potential, just like a heart medicine or, a blood pressure medication, maybe there's a way we can intervene sooner to keep people healthy and vivacious.
And that, along with the prevention angle, it sounds like if we start exercising, some of the research, I think from Finland, was looking at getting people into supervised exercise programs early on. So that's even before we're detecting Alzheimer's that we're doing this prevention.
Correct. Yeah. So they used a randomized trial. So one group of people went into a very structured routine and they were monitored fairly often. So it was not that they were self-reporting some of these events or exercise routines, but they were consistently monitored. And another group just had basically some education given to them without that kind of active participation module. And they were followed up over a few years, and that one group who really kind of had that major lifestyle change was seen to have some healthier cognition. Spinning that locally, the Alzheimer's Association actually just funded a like study to that here in the Madison community. So we're taking a global issue and actually making it a local participation as well.
Oh, so there will be research on people here in Wisconsin doing similar sorts of things?
There will be, and that's the best part about this international conference. We have many of our scientists with the UW and in Milwaukee. Many of them actually go and share some of their data. And one of the studies that we're excited about with the Alzheimer's Association are these health and lifestyle changes. We think those are real solutions that people are looking for ways to really kind of, if they have a family history, ways they can really identify a potential risk and turn it into a method of activism and taking control of your life personally and making some positive changes.
Well, it sounds like you could be teaming up on public health campaigns with heart health and cancer health groups, because a lot of the same behaviors have benefits in all those areas.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think the door's starting to open on this issue, and it's exciting to see what's going to happen.
You know, I think I have, and I probably share a misconception with a lot of people, that Alzheimer's is the dementia. That is the symptom. That is the disease. There's a lot more going on than just that, though, isn't there?
Sure, yeah. It's more than memory loss. You know, Alzheimer's disease really affects your independence, your ability to navigate in the community without having to rely on others. So it can be your judgment, your orientation. You can get confused and not be able to navigate to your home or to, you know, the shopping mall. And so we're seeing it affect younger people. So it's not just an 85-plus sort of a disease anymore. And the state is really taking notice in Wisconsin of this growing demographic of people who are experiencing cognitive challenges with dementias. You might recall in the spring we made a new law called the Silver Alert Bill, because people are still getting behind the wheel and driving and getting confused and disoriented. So it presents differently from person to person. So it's a very complex disorder, but Alzheimer's is far and wide the most common. About 70% of the cases of dementias after people are over the age of 65.
Now, despite the good news we've been talking about prevention, about early detection, a lot of people have Alzheimer's now. A lot of people will continue to develop it over the years. How are we doing in Wisconsin as far as helping them live as independent and fulfilled life as they possibly can?
Well, I think the Alzheimer's Association, we're in every county in the state. There's three chapters that cover the entire state. We're all working with caregivers, with persons with the disease, to make sure that we are really kind of engaging them, overcoming some of these social stigmas, getting people involved in caregiver classes and workshops and things like that to learn more about changes and kind of take some of that stress away as much as possible if we can educate some of the families going through this. And I think it shocks a lot of people. For example, our 2014 Alzheimer's Association Facts and Figures report that we put out every March. We know that about a third of the senior population is affected by some sort of dementia. So the fact that these families aren't getting access to services is quite astounding, but they feel like they really are in this by themselves. And when you're looking at a third of the population, and that actually increases to about 50% when people are over 85, there's a huge amount of families that are really affected by this. So we need to overcome and support those people who are in this battle.
What kind of help is out there for people in that family situation?
Sure, sure. Well, the Alzheimer's Association is a great resource. We offer a 24/7 helpline that's staffed by medical professionals, social workers, or nurses who can take a call and offer any sort of basic inquiry or question about Alzheimer's disease to really more of a case management or care consultation level of a call. So that's a free service that's available to everybody. The ALZ.org is our main website. We have a lot of great instruction videos, a sample of how to have a conversation about removing driving privileges, or how can we have some dialogue in the family about seeking a medical evaluation. We have samples conversations with that. I just did a program this morning on knowing the early warning signs of Alzheimer's disease. So often there can be other conditions that can cloud your cognitive performance, so we want to make sure it's really identified properly with a medical evaluation. And then we offer classes in our communities, you know, those caregiving classes, access to resources. We also have another great social support site kind of for people who aren't willing to go to one of those caregiver groups called All's Connected. It's almost like a Facebook for Alzheimer's caregivers.
I'm going to jump in and we can get into that a little more. We're talking to Carrie Patterson of the Alzheimer's Association about some of the news coming out of the organization's international conference, including the news that lifestyle changes can help prevent future memory loss.
And we'd like to take your calls. Have you made any lifestyle changes to help prevent Alzheimer's? What are you doing to stave off memory loss? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We'll continue the conversation after a look at the news here on Central Time.
We're continuing our conversation now with Carrie Patterson of the Alzheimer's Association about some of the latest Alzheimer's research.
And we want to hear from you. Have you made lifestyle changes to help prevent Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia? Have you experienced Alzheimer's in your life, in your family? Call, share your stories and experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Carrie, one recent headline that caught our eye, Alzheimer's rates seem to be going down in developed countries. They're attributing that to improved heart health. While the aging population means there are going to be more people with Alzheimer's, even though the rates are going down. Does that match up with what you're seeing?
Well, you know, that was a new study that just came out, and certainly would be exciting if that were applicable to the entire globe. So the governments, I believe it was in Sweden and England, the Netherlands, and perhaps Germany, if I'm recalling correctly, they are seeing some prevention, certainly kind of better, more aggressive treatments for that heart health issue that we've been talking about so much in this program. But we're not quite sure if that is going to be a trend that is going to continue. Certainly rising obesity and diabetes could come into play. So the answer is we just don't quite know yet if that's going to really be more of an isolated issue or if that's going to be a trend within that one study group. Another segment of that question is we don't really know if lower and middle income countries will have the fastest decline as well, because those populations are really experiencing a boom in the aging community. So I think that's what's exciting about research. We've seen trends emerge when we do go after some of these other lifestyle factors where there is a potential where we could age with a better outcome with health, and maybe that will link to cognitive health. But again, that was one study that needs to be duplicated in more of a longitudinal mechanism. But overall, Alzheimer's disease, barring any sort of major prevention, will continue to grow quite rapidly. And we're looking at doubling in 20 years globally. So, you know, right now it's still too early to say if that's really going to be a trend that will continue or not.
All right, we'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Robin on the line in Onalaska. Robin, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I've got a question. I've got a son who has Down syndrome, and I've been to many seminars and conferences. I've heard that the population of people with Down syndrome, if they live to a certain age, will develop early onset Alzheimer's disease. And I've always wondered why here's a known population that will it definitively have Alzheimer's. Why there haven't been studies or some type of preventative medication, you know, researches that the new research comes out that they could be studied and see if what kind of effect it has on a known population.
Robin, thanks for that call and that question. Susan, Down syndrome and Alzheimer's, is that something you're familiar with?
Yeah, I mean, they have been involved in a lot of clinical research throughout the country. So Wisconsin doesn't have any study specific enrolling that population, but that doesn't mean it's not out there. So there is a site called clinicaltrials.gov that you can actually search for some of those keywords and find locations that are enrolling that population. But we know that some of the cognitive challenges that goes along with Down syndrome is definitely a risk for developing Alzheimer's disease in people's later years. Now that might manifest itself in this younger onset. So when we use younger onset, we're talking about a population that is younger than the age of 65. So sometimes they do have some challenges with Alzheimer's or another dementia, absolutely, and they are being studied. So I think you can rest assured that people are looking into that. But, yeah, definitely a great idea for further collaboration.
Robin, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Susan now in Madison. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me on. Couple points. My father passed away with Alzheimer's a couple years ago, so I'm sort of always watching what's the latest. One thing I want to give a shout out to the Alzheimer's Association in Madison, how wonderful and supportive they are to families. People should reach out to them. Second is there was a study I heard briefly about earlier this week in Sweden where they saw some bright dots in the eyes. They're doing some research. It's called beta amyloids that they found in the eyes that appear to be associated with Alzheimer's and maybe a breakthrough in determining whether someone is going to get it or not. Hmm. Have you heard anything about that?
Susan, thanks for that call. Is that one of those biomarkers you were talking about, Carrie, or is that one you've run across?
That is. You know, that just broke this week. So thank you so much for your encouragement there. That's one of those early risk factors that are so exciting to hear about this week. We learned about new smell tests, new eye exams. You know, so many of these families undergo challenges with getting that loved one into this full memory diagnostic evaluation. But people notice when their smell changes or their taste changes or balance changes. And eyesight is definitely one we want to pay attention to as well. So beta amyloid is one of those big biomarkers in the brain. It's really kind of a protein and another plaque substance that develop over time. And so we're starting to see some of these early screeners, which can be one of those things that might trigger a further evaluation and come from someone who's kind of less threatening, you know, your eye doctor. I think that's really exciting to see some initial findings on that.
Susan, thanks so much for that call and for bringing that up. And sorry for your loss, by the way. Carrie, Susan also put in a plug for the Alzheimer's Association. That reminded me, you were talking about kind of a Facebook for people, for families dealing with Alzheimer's?
Yeah, exactly. So in addition to our in-person caregiver groups in our community, we also have an online support system. You know, we Google things before we pick up a phone or set up a meeting so often. So on ALZ.org, there's a new service called Alz Connected, which is a tool that family caregivers can communicate with others throughout the country. So if they have a question about mealtime or bathing or driving or safety, they can talk with other families and get some of those tools and techniques we would normally talk about in a support group. But people are more comfortable online, so we wanted to make sure we were there.
And you mentioned that you gave a talk just this morning on early warning signs of
yes.
Alzheimer's. What are a couple few things that people might be on the lookout for?
Sure. You know, anything that's really starting to disrupt your day-to-day functioning, whether it's forgetting appointments or forgetting to send that birthday card and doing that repeatedly, you know, outside of some of those senior moments, we all have lapses once in a while, but when it becomes more of a pattern, we really want to pay attention to that. Also, more complex planning or problem solving. It can be anything from making a familiar recipe to if you're that type of person who likes to tinker and take things apart, and if you can't put them back together again like you once were, that would be a real risk and warning sign for us. Getting lost, getting disoriented, starting to get scratches on the car or driving citations. Families might want to take note and see if that person is having a problem navigating. Word finding, speaking, writing, putting emails out there that just quite honestly don't make sense. These are all things that would make me raise my eyebrow if I were a family member. So it's more than just memory loss. Payments are another thing, your financial matters. So if you're overpaying invoices, you know, to the gas and electric company, or if you're missing bills, that can be a real sign to families. So we have our Know the 10 Signs on ALZ.org, or our staff can talk to you about those in more depth.
And just briefly, if you're seeing those signs, what's the first step?
Give us a call. 1-800-272-3900 is that helpline number, or you can connect with your local chapter. We are in the Madison community as well, and our number is 203-8500. And we're happy to talk with you. I think it might not be Alzheimer's. It could be something else, and we can help strategize, learn more about your particular situation, and work with you on what's the appropriate next step.
Carrie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you.
That's Carrie Patterson, Executive Director of the South Central Wisconsin Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Each week at this time, we invite someone to teach us what they know. Last week, we learned how to podcast. This week, we're going to find out how to explore a new, unfamiliar city. Whether traveling alone or with someone else, the process of plotting out that itinerary can be time-consuming and a little overwhelming.
Carolyn Jeanette joins us to help us get the most out of our next adventure. She has over 20 years of traveling experience and has visited 5 of the 7 continents. She's the owner and the director of tours at Inroads Ireland, and she joins us from Ireland. Carolyn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, what's the first thing we need to do once we've decided where exactly we want to head to next?
You know, that's the perfect question to start. Like, where do you start? And really, what I always do first is I really try to do my research and read up on the city, you know, read the history, get a sense of the neighborhoods, you know, do your homework as it is. You can get a sense of where sites are located, you know, distances between places, and what public transport systems are available in the city. And by doing all that, you're going to get a sense of what interests you and what types of things you might want to do.
And what should we be thinking about when we set those priorities before we get there?
Well, you know, everyone's really different. I think for me, you know, a lot of it comes down to how much time do I have in a place. You know, for example, if let's say I'm going to New York City and I have just like a day or two and I've never been there before, you know, maybe there's like one thing that I've always wanted to see. Maybe I've always wanted to go to the top of the Empire State Building or, you know, get out to see the Statue of Liberty. But, you know, if you're somewhere for a week, you may want to kind of combine doing some, you know, known things with some kind of just relaxing days where maybe just go up to say, I'm going to use New York City again as an example. Just spend a day where you just like, you know, grab some bread and cheese and some fruits and go to Central Park and just hang out for the afternoon and or just go for a wander around that neighborhood and see what happens.
What advice do you have for someone who wants to maybe get off the beaten path? You know, in New York, it's might be an obvious choice to see the Statue of Liberty or some of those other things. But what if we're not quite sure where to go? We just want to absorb the local culture.
Yeah, you know, always getting that local perspective always adds another layer to visiting a city. And, you know, I have to say, staying in smaller places really, really helps in terms of bridging that gap, because you can read lots of guidebooks and they'll have, you know, good local suggestions, but actually talking with someone from that city or that town and getting their ideas will really help make a trip even more special. So when I look at accommodations, you know, I'll look at local guest houses, bed and breakfasts, and even, you know, hostels. You know, back in the day, hostels were kind of known as more youth hostels, and backpackers would share rooms with, you know, 12 people, but they've really grown up as accommodation styles have grown up. So nowadays you can, you know, get, you know, double rooms with bathrooms attached, and they're lovely places to stay. And another little shout out for hostels is that they'll actually organize little local things in neighborhoods. Like, for example, just last year I was in Lisbon, Portugal, and I was staying in a hostel with my husband, And they had, like, for, say, €6, they were going to do a little tour of a district called the Alfama District, which started a musical tradition called Fado. And for €6 only, there was about 10 of us that ended up walking around. We stopped in three different little local places. And at midnight, we were taken to this little Fado session in this little bar that, you know, I never would have found myself. Mm. And so kind of having that local person say, I want to share my neighborhood and my district with you, we got this amazing experience, and it was really great.
So it's key, it sounds like, to get those special memories, not the postcard everybody else has seen, but something that's unique, and maybe you're the only tourist who saw that day.
Yeah, exactly. And even on that same night when we were in Lisbon, sardines are the national fish of Portugal. And, you know, we saw people, like, literally just grilling sardines on little portable outdoor grills. And it's like €2, they gave us, like, this beautiful sardine that was freshly grilled with butter and garlic on this bun. And you're just like, wow, this is just, you know, fantastic. Because lots of times those unplanned moments, then you just kind of open yourself up to exploring a city. Those are the best things, I think, that really help create great travel memories.
Do you have any advice for just taking off on foot without necessarily a map or a destination?
Just wandering, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, I do. There's kind of a yes and a no to that. I've traveled a lot on my own, so I kind of have adopted this sense of go for a wander. I always like research neighborhoods because I want to know what's safe and what's not safe, kind of, you know, get a sense of that. And I want to kind of have a sense-ish of where I'm going. So I'll know, like, say, like, in these next, like, say, 5-6 blocks-ish area, it's all, you know, a pretty good zone. And then I'll literally just kind of go and I'll walk around and just take in local sites. And something that's helpful, too, is that a lot of cities will offer, you know, walking tours. And it might just be, like, an hour or two, but it will kind of give you an introduction to the city or, like, a hop-on, hop-off bus tour kind of thing. But, again, kind of getting the introduction, then you can say, oh, I want to go back and spend more time in that park, or that shop looked really interesting, or that little cafe looked interesting. So it's a nice way to kind of get your bearings, and then you can kind of feel more confident going out and kind of wandering about on your own.
You know, while you're doing that walk or checking out that small place, a lot of us may, remember our parents telling us not to talk to strangers. I know you say there's actually maybe a lot to be gained from talking to that person in the bar and, as you mentioned, at the hostel.
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, I tell you, you know, I have traveled around the world, and I have to say, people are generally pretty darn helpful, and they love sharing their city or their town with you or sharing a story. And one little strategy that, like, domestically when I've traveled, because obviously we speak English in America, if you're going into a town or something and just go into the bar, because bars, whether you drink alcohol or not, are just great places to connect with people. So whatever it is that you like. So when I go to a bar, I'll tend to like look down the bar and see if people are doing like Coke or if they're drinking some particular kind of beer or something. And I'll just look and I'll just order whatever everyone else is drinking. So it's kind of like I'm trying to fit in with them. And then the fact that you sit at the bar and you're saying, hey, I'm open for conversation. And I'll just say, I'll see something up on a wall, like, you know, a meat raffle or, you know, something like that. I go, oh, what's going on with that? You know, and you just kind of start the conversation. And pretty soon people, you know, tell you, oh, there's this thing down the road that you really should check out. And, you know, now I'm here in Ireland and, you know, pubs are such part of a big part of culture here. And so if you want to ever strike up a conversation, Ireland is the perfect place to do it. There's plenty of people that will want to share a story with you.
And you also even recommend meetup.com. What does that do for us?
Yeah, meetup.com, that's an interesting group. That's actually international. And they organize different groups around the world just based on common interests. So it's a nice way that if you want to try to connect with people with like interests, you can just go to the website meetup.com, and they'll have lots of different local events going on. So there might be like, you know, a group is going to meet at this cafe to talk about a book, or there's going to be some kayak group heading out on Saturday. So again, depending on your time frame and how flexible your schedule is, you could join them. And so then you're meeting people from that city and doing something that you like to do anyways. And then I'm sure you're going to come away with a lot of friends after doing one of those.
You know, if we're not experienced travelers and we're liking the sound of this and want to explore a city that's not too intimidating, are there easier places to get our feet wet when it comes to urban travel?
Yeah. I would say in general, starting off with an English-speaking city is going to be an easier experience for you. You know, so, you know, places like London, a little shout out to Dublin here, Sydney, Australia, anywhere in the United States, I think would be easy. Canada. Canada is a great place to go to. And actually going to French Canada, you know, Montreal or Quebec City is lovely because you do definitely get a European flavor, but there is still English spoken. So I would say going off, that's how I kind of started. I went off to English speaking cities, but, you know, that were in different countries. And then as you travel more, your confidence really grows with each experience. And you realize that language isn't as much of a barrier as you think it might be. You know, English is a pretty international language nowadays. And if you kind of can learn a few key words in different countries you go to, you can really get around quite easily.
You've talked about having us do our homework and plan ahead before we embark on our trip. But how should our approach be different if our destination is international?
Yeah, well, you know, it's not a whole lot different, I have to say. You know, like whether I'm looking at, say, going to Lisbon or to, say, Moscow or Oslo, Norway, or I was just down in Savannah, Georgia recently, my approach is always kind of similar, that I just really start by reading about the city, getting a sense of the neighborhoods. That's always because really larger cities, which can seem kind of intimidating, are really just collections of smaller communities. And so once you start reading about those, it feels very relatable. So even if you're traveling internationally, you know, I'd say I'm going to pick on Oslo now because I was just about there a year or two ago. Again, I didn't know anything about this place. But I just kind of, you know, read about the history of it, got a sense of, you know, where the train stations are, where the bus stations are, where the airport is, get a sense of public transport, how things are kind of connected in that city. And I'll do that just honestly by getting a book from the library or using online resources or looking up a, you know, just a factual article on Wikipedia or something. And simply just reading up about it. And then based on that and what I want to see and do, I'll kind of formulate a plan in terms of like, oh, I have X amount of time there. I want to be more centrally located versus like being farther out of a city and having to commute, say, 30 minutes in and out each time on a train, you know? So it's kind of the same approach, whether you travel, say, domestically or internationally. The one thing is, though, if you do travel internationally and you don't speak the local language, it can be helpful, you know, to stay like at a little pension or guest house, B&B or hostel, because then your host typically will speak English. And they can really help, you know, point you in different directions and give that local inside perspective.
Carolyn, thank you so much for sharing your advice with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Hope you guys have a great day.
You too. Carolyn Jeanette is owner and director of tours at InRoads Ireland, teaching us what she knows about exploring a new city.